Thanks again for joining us today. We are going to be joined by Boots, and I just want to give a quick trigger warning that we will be discussing suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, sexual abuse. And if you're not in a place to hear that today, maybe save this episode for another day.
All of my interactions in like elementary school and middle school were very strange because everyone thought I was the weirdo because I was the JW kid. Mm. And I wasn't allowed to have friends outside of the congregations. And I was the youngest of five. So as the baby of the family, none of them wanted me hanging around with them and their friends.
Right.
So I was really isolated a lot. And I really didn't develop healthy interactions with other people. And it's something I still struggle with. I also put that to being neurodivergent on top of being isolated. Those are two things that really hinder my ability to be social. But I don't really think of it as a problem, even though it makes things difficult. One of the things I love is it kind of vets people, because you're either going to love me or think I'm so weird that you want nothing to do with me. And I'm okay with that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So my father was an elder in the Orchard Heights congregation here in Sioux Falls, and he was also a circuit overseer. So on weekends, we would travel all over the state, sometimes into Iowa and Minnesota, to congregations for him to speak. And Tuesday nights were Bible study, book study, and Thursday nights were also meetings. And then we were expected, even as children, to go door to door and proselytize. And it was really humiliating when I would end up being at a door and be expected to talk when I see a classmate there. And they're like, why are you dressed like that? Why are you here? It made me more weird than I already was. Mm-hmm. So from a young age, I kind of knew that I was the abomination that they kept talking about in the meetings. And I really didn't know how to put my finger on it, but I knew I was the other. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of anxiety from a young age. I went through sexual abuse when I was younger, from the ages 4 to 7.5. And when I tried talking about it, it was covered up. And that's actually super common for Jehovah's Witnesses. I have podcast that I listen to. They're called Sinisterhood. Great podcast. But they actually just recently released a 3-part series on Jehovah's Witnesses, what it looks like on the inside, the history of it, how it was founded, the history of the guys that founded it, all of that stuff. So it's extensive and really well done. And they also have a Listener Tales episode that they put out with Jehovah's Witness stories. And you will hear that mine is not the least bit an isolated experience, and actually, unfortunately, really common. And by middle school, I kind of figured out what was going on with myself. And as a person that really doesn't know how to get along correctly with other humans, I didn't realize that I had to protect myself. So when I came out to someone I thought was my friend, the entire school knew by the end of the day. Mm. And she and her other friend had made up that I had threatened to rape another student, which it would have never occurred to me to even say something like that, or think of it. Since I was the gay, it had to be true. So I was brought to the principal's office, and they called my parents and told my parents I was gay. And my parents agreed with the principal that I was a problem and they needed to do something about me.
Hello, everybody. This is Jack, the co-host of the podcast. And I just wanted to take a quick minute to tell you all about our really exciting survey opportunity that we have. This is the first ever LGBTQ plus survey that has been done in the state of South Dakota. So that's super exciting. If you are part of the community and you're over the age of 18, please, please take a few minutes after listening to a podcast to participate and have your voice heard. This is going to change access to healthcare. It's going to change the way that you have access to services in the state of South Dakota. And if you know of anybody else who could benefit from taking the survey, please let them know. There will be a link in the description. Thank you.
Welcome back to Becoming Visible Trans Stories. My name's Jack, and I am here with my co-host Susan, and we are joined by Boots today. Boots, can you just tell us your name, your pronouns, how you identify, anything else you want to tell us about yourself?
My name is Boots. My pronouns are they, them. I identify as queer and non-binary and two-spirit.
Nice. What else do you want to know?
That's all. We're done.
Have a good day.
All right. Have a great night.
That's all, folks.
I founded a nonprofit for gender diverse youth 5 years ago. This month is actually our 5-year anniversary, if you can believe that.
That's incredible. Tell us all about it.
So the name is Quilting Allies. We make quilts for gender diverse youth dealing with suicidal ideation and self-harm behaviors. We get referrals from various places, and we speak to the parents of the kids about what they might want on the quilt, if they have certain fabrics that help them calm down more, if they have favorite colors that calm them down, if they geek out on any certain subjects and they want quilt squares that are having those subjects on them. So the community can participate in this project by writing or drawing uplifting comments or pictures onto the quilt squares. And then we sew them together in the flag that the kid identifies with, and whatever fabric they choose for the back. And they're a little bit heavy. They're a bit weighted, but not officially a weighted blanket. And the idea behind them is to go ahead and put them on when they're not doing well. And because they're a little bit heavier, to help bring down the anxiety and the crisis, to give them enough time to say, hey, I'm not doing so good right now. I need some help.
How many of those have you done so far?
We actually really don't keep count because that's not our mission, but I think it's somewhere around 20.
Nice.
It's incredible. I know we've seen many of the quilts get handed out to the kids, and just I know several of the people that help you sew and get excited about that, just making such a difference for these youth. And so it's pretty incredible what you started and where it's come to.
Well, we don't like why we started. There was a community member whose child completed suicide at 15 years old, and they were a member of our community, and it was devastating. And a bunch of their parents' friends got together and made them a quilt like this and gave it to them. And my thought was, maybe if we made these for the kids, we wouldn't have to be comforting parents. And it was kind of a healing process to start this as a way to honor their life and their struggle and not just focus on the way they died. So
I think that's something that we all deal with in the work that we do is suicidal ideation or suicide attempts or suicide completion. And I think that's, I don't know, it's absolutely heartbreaking each time.
And especially the way it's gotten so intense over the last several years because of people politicizing our existence and turning us into the other to be hunted, to take away from what they're really doing while they're in office, and the corruption and all of the monies that they end up getting to get reelected and make favors and things like that. And no one needs to be a scapegoat. And it's unfortunate that it's our youth
that have been scapegoated, and we need to do everything we can to keep them alive. And the existence of older trans people is really vital to that, because they're going to see that people make it. And that's really important to have visible elders around them, especially ones who are healthy enough to be role models.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Which can be hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Even as an older trans person, that can also be difficult. So yeah, it's definitely important.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and your story, Boots, and we'll just let you talk. And maybe if you feel like, I mean, we'll ask questions if we think of them, but just share.
Sure. I was born and raised here in Sioux Falls, and I've been here my whole life. My father was originally from Watertown, South Dakota, but my mother was from Brooklyn, New York. She grew up in the Kings County Projects. And the reason they met is my father went to ministry school in Bethel in Manhattan for the Jehovah's Witnesses. And he was a conscientious objector to Vietnam. And he was pioneering in her community and met her family. And he was there for many years until he finished ministry school. And then he moved a brown Puerto Rican woman who's never been outside of a big city to Rock Valley, Iowa in 1972.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So that was a really hard transition from her. And, you know, growing up in the Kings County's projects, she's surrounded by people just like her. So she's never been in a situation where she's only been the only brown person. And then she was immediately put into that when she was brought to Rock Valley, Iowa. Mm-hmm. So that was really hard for her. And my my father's family's racist, and they were not kind to my mother. So when we came out light-skinned, she really didn't teach us anything about our culture. And she figured we were protected by our white presenting privilege, which indeed we have been. And we really didn't learn anything. We never really learned anything about her life, what she went through, anything. Growing up Jehovah's Witness, there isn't really any kind of culture. There is only Jehovah's Witness. Trying to explore that as an adult has been difficult because I don't really know how to fit into everyday relationships with non-Jehovah's Witnesses, because we didn't interact like everyday people interact. It was a very isolated, insular community. And all of my interactions in like elementary school and middle school were very strange, because everyone thought I was the weirdo because I was the JW kid. Mm. And I wasn't allowed to have friends outside of the congregations. And I was the youngest of five. So as the baby of the family, none of them wanted me hanging around with them and their friends.
Right.
So I was really isolated a lot. And I really didn't develop healthy interactions with other people. And it's something I still struggle with. I also put that to being neurodivergent on top of being isolated. Mm-hmm. Those are two things that really hinder my ability to be social. But I don't really think of it as a problem, even though it makes things difficult. One of the things I love is it kind of vets people, because you're either going to love me or think I'm so weird that you want nothing to do with me. And I'm okay with that.
Boy.
Yeah. So my father was an elder in the Orchard Heights congregation here in Sioux Falls, and he was also a circuit overseer. So on weekends, we would travel all over the state, sometimes into Iowa and Minnesota, to congregations for him to speak. And Tuesday nights were Bible study, book study, and Thursday nights were also meetings. And then we were expected, even as children, to go door to door and proselytize. And it was really humiliating when I would end up being at a door and be expected to talk when I see a classmate there. And they're like, mm-hmm. Why are you dressed like that? Why are you here? like, it made me more weird than I already was. So from a young age, I kind of knew that I was the abomination that they kept talking about in the meetings. And I really didn't know how to put my finger on it, but I knew I was the other. And I had a lot of anxiety from a young age. I went through sexual abuse when I was younger, from the ages 4 to 7.5. And when I tried talking about it, it was covered up. And that's actually super common for Jehovah's Witnesses. I have podcasts that I listen to. They're called Sinisterhood, great podcast. But they actually just recently released a 3-part series on Jehovah's Witnesses, what it looks like on the inside, the history of it, how it found, how it was founded, the history of the guys that founded it, all of that stuff. So it's extensive and really well done. And they also have a Listener Tales episode that they put out with Jehovah's Witness stories. And you will hear that mine is not the least bit an isolated experience, and actually, unfortunately, really common. And by middle school, I kind of figured out what was going on with myself. And as a person that really doesn't know how to get along correctly with other humans, I didn't realize that I had to protect myself. So when I came out to someone I thought was my friend, the entire school knew by the end of the day. And she and her other friend had made up that I had threatened to rape another student, which it would have never occurred to me to even say something like that, or think of it. But since I was the gay, it had to be true. So I was brought to the principal's office, and they called my parents and told my parents I was a gay. And my parents agreed with the principal that I was a problem and they needed to do something about me. So they were trying to figure that out for about 2 weeks, talking back and forth with the school. And they had done nothing to stop the rumor mill, nothing to help me in any way. So within about 2 weeks of that, I was suicidal because of all of the abuse I was catching at school. So they used that as an opportunity to institutionalize me. Since you can't be institutionalized anymore for being a gay, they used that to put me in Sioux Valley Behavioral Health. And I spent maybe a week and a half there. And then they shipped me down to Human Services Center in Yankton, where I spent the next 5 months or so. And it was honestly not that hard to find counselors that were also anti-LGBT and use it to try to find out what was wrong with me. Like, there's some kind of root for queerness. And if you find out the trauma, you can fix it. So after the 5 months, they discharged me, and I got sent back home, and my parents started Bible therapy with me. I wasn't allowed to go anywhere without them. I wasn't really allowed to do anything. It was really difficult, and my siblings absolutely hated me because with the way Jehovah's Witness beliefs work, I could destroy their chances at everlasting life, because they are associated with my gayness and allowing it to happen. So I am going to put them in the position of dying the second death, which is what Jehovah's Witnesses believe in their version of the Bible. There's no such thing as hell. You'll die once, but after Armageddon, you'll rise again. And you die the second death when you don't get that chance to rise with everyone else. It's a permanent death. Mm. So that's what they were facing because of me. Mm. So there was a lot of harassment of why I don't just stop it and get with the program and be a good witness. The next year, going into school, within a couple weeks of school starting, you know, ending up in high school with the same people from my middle school, I got suicidal again pretty quick and got put in Sioux Valley again for a couple of weeks. And that became the regular. Every couple of months, I would end up needing to be put in some kind of mental health ward because of suicidal behavior and cutting. And I started sneaking out at night. There's nothing quite as comforting as 3 a.m. when the world is silent. Mm. Like even the birds are silent and you have that dewy air that's still crisp. And it's just so peaceful that I don't even really have words for the catharsis. So that was my refuge.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of calming, repetitive behaviors that nobody ever recognized as any type of neurodivergence at that point in time. But looking back on it, it's pretty obvious. I didn't know how to deal with all of this, and no one was actually helping me deal with it. They were still just trying to fix what was wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And so I could be normal, and, you know, their reputation was affected by the fact that I was not ungaying fast enough. Mm-hmm. And you get into my sophomore year of high school, the bullying is so much worse. You know, within a couple of weeks of school again, I was institutionalized again at Sioux Valley Behavioral Health. And while we were doing rec there, I actually ended up rolling my ankle and breaking my foot. And they made me walk back to the unit on my broken foot because they said I was just trying to get attention and to knock it off. So I ended up getting a specific pattern of bruising on my foot that was indicative for a heel fracture. And I called my parents and was like, they're not listening to me, but mm-hmm. there's something really wrong. So thankfully, my parents listened and they had me discharged and took me to the hospital, and I had shattered my heel. Mm. And the part that broke off and shattered was bad enough that the only thing that they could do is open up my foot and kind of scrape out the pieces so that they wouldn't cut the muscle around the rest of it. Wow. So it took a long time to recover, but going through the halls between classes, the kids would actually aim for my boot. And they would hurt me by purposely stepping on my broken foot. And when I got off of my crutches, I was still leaving the classes early. And my Spanish teacher asked me why I was still leaving early if I wasn't on crutches anymore. And I told her it's because people are aiming for my boot in the hallway. And she goes, well, you know why they're doing that, right? It's because God created men to be with women and women to be with men. I didn't even know what to say with her. She was just like my family. So I just turned around and walked away and went to my next class. And actually, my sophomore year of high school was the first time in my life that I actually met someone that didn't think homosexual people were the worst thing in the world. It was my Algebra 2 teacher, and she said, I don't care. My brother's gay. You know, this doesn't affect me. You are yourself.
Right.
And my mind was absolutely blown. She was the first adult I ever met that had that attitude. And I didn't even realize people could have that attitude. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still think of her. Because the fact that she was human to me and honestly didn't care because it was none of her business. Mm-hmm. You know, like I didn't realize how bad I needed that. I just assumed everybody was like them.
Mm-hmm.
So
That's incredible.
Yeah. My parents started me with a new therapist through Southeastern Behavioral Health. And her name was Connie Spasiro. And I told her about the last several years of what I had been going through with my family. And she had this look of utter horror on her face and said, "That's child abuse. I need to report this." Mm. And she did. And my parents went after her license to practice. And obviously, they didn't win anything by it because they're the bastards, not the therapist. And she kept her license and she still practices. Mm-hmm. But she was the first healthcare professional that informed me that what I was going through was abuse. And honestly, that didn't occur to me either. I thought that was just how life went. Mm-hmm. But after they had gone after her, I wasn't allowed to see her anymore. And I tipped off again and went back to Sioux Valley Behavioral Health. And within 2 weeks of that, they transferred me down to Human Services Center the second time, where I stayed for 4.5 months. And I was 15 that time. And, you know, the worst thing about both of the times that I was there is that the people they have working down there that are supposed to be teachers aren't actually legally certified as teachers. So even though I did all sorts of classwork down there, none of it got taken as credits for school. So my senior year of high school, I actually had to sign a waiver to take 7 classes a day each semester so that I could actually pass because of how much time I missed being locked up. And, you know, as a my particular type of neurodivergence, I really don't mind that kind of work. And honestly, it got me out of the cafeteria away from the crappy students. Mm-hmm. So I was really grateful for it. But my first 2 years for freshman and sophomore year, I was at Washington High School where I went through the most of the abuse. And then the second time I went to Lincoln for 2 days. But then a girl I had dated over the summer, her mother actually had caught us in bed, and she, instead of risking getting in trouble, she told her mother that I had raped her pressured her into it. So she immediately started that, rumor at the school. And when I got wind of that, I'm like, nope, I'm not living through this again.
No.
And I transferred to Roosevelt, and at Roosevelt, I instantly turned into a mean person because I wanted to create a persona that nobody would mess with. Mm. And it worked. I became a person that when I walked through the hallway, the crowd parted to get away from me. And that was the first time in my life people left me alone. So in my brain, that translates to aggression works. Mm-hmm. Aggression will keep you safe. And I followed that path for many years. And with my anger and aggression and intimidation. You know, I never got in a physical fight with anybody, but the threat of it was enough to make people leave me alone. But when that was seen, I was recruited by white supremacists. Now, I am a mixed race person, but have white presenting privilege. Mm-hmm. So to me, I kind of felt like the fox in the chicken coop as this mixed race, queer person around a bunch of Nazis. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a power trip, like they're too stupid to realize what I am. But it also gave me opportunities to share my aggression with people and feel like I belonged to a community. And I didn't have that. I had been ostracized from the only community I knew. So any type of community was better than what I was doing previously. So I did get radicalized. And that way, the technique that they used to recruit me, it doesn't necessarily go with only white supremacists. Any radicalized group uses those kinds of tactics to recruit and radicalize for whatever their mission is. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what. And I had gone to a bunch of rallies and things like that, but I had gone to an after party on somebody's property and they had a bonfire and were enjoying themselves. And the way they were talking about other people, the way they were degrading other people, I just couldn't handle it. Mm-hmm. Like, I was never raised that way. You know, I may be a gay, but I wasn't racist. I grew up being treated like that because my dad's parents called us mud babies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know what it feels like to feel like that by those people. So I became disenfranchised with the group and fell out of it. And I kind of hit rock bottom at that point because here I am the second time in my life without any sort of community, completely hated for what I really am. Mm-hmm. And I ended up becoming homeless because after all of this trauma, I really couldn't function in any capacity and my mental health was so severe. I kept losing jobs after like 3 or 6 weeks. And after a while, my job history got so bad, nobody would hire me. So I was jobless in the back of my Saturn Ion in the winter of 2008, 2009, because the shelters wouldn't take me because I'm a gay. And that makes me a threat to everyone in the women's shelter. And, you know, obviously that's not the first time I've heard that. So I just sleep in the back of my car through a whole winter. And at this point, with all of my traumas building up on me, I didn't know it at the time, but I had PTSD. And my PTSD developed dissociative features. And you don't know when you dissociate. It just kind of happens and you come back wherever you're at and you don't know how you got there. So I had had an episode of that happen that lasted 3 days. And I was technically still transient because I was living in a girlfriend's apartment at the time. And she had become an ex-girlfriend. But in this, somewhere in this 3 day episode, I had actually slit my wrist. And when I came to, I was sitting at her kitchen table, eating a bowl of Life cereal and big old puddle of blood on the floor. And I was still completely numb. So even though I was aware, I was still partially dissociated. So I reached down onto the floor and ran my hand through it. And I still felt no motion. The only reaction I really had, the only thought I had in my head was, well, that didn't feel like I thought it would. And I had noticed I had a text message on my phone. And I had responded to it, but the response was so garbled mm-hmm. that she immediately called my ex and was like, something is wrong. We have to go check on Boots. And they did. And they found me like that. And they brought me to the hospital. They brought me to the ER. And I had to get several stitches. But they were so busy, they couldn't get anyone from mental health down to evaluate me for 3 hours. Mm. And they left me in my room alone for 3 hours because they didn't have the staff to deal with me and watch me while they had a busy ER. So I'm just sitting in that room, staring at this bandage on my wrist, waiting for someone to come down. And, you know, I knew I was a mess, but I didn't know what kind of a mess because I had no understanding besides the chaos I've already lived through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the first time I am hospitalized as an adult in an adult unit. And they don't treat you the same way as they do in the youth units at all. Mm-hmm. So the experience was very different. And they actually got me connected with services that I actually needed. They connected me with Southeastern, the Fifth Street Connection, which is the homeless outreach portion. Mm-hmm. And they worked with the county to get me an apartment. So for the first time in a season, I had a place to live. And they had the county paying my rent every month and they put me on Medicaid and, you know, they gave me food stamps. So this was the first time I had regularly eaten in quite a while. And, I was just so sick and I thought maybe just everything's caught up with me, mm-hmm. you know? So I went to the community health clinic and got checked out, and they run blood tests, and the doctor just says, oh, you're not sick at all. You're just pregnant. And I'm like, what? Okay, so there's no possible way that this is a real thing. And you've clearly mixed up my blood with someone else's. How about you take some more and do it right this time? And, you know, he had someone come take my blood again. But then they did the hormone test on it and found that it coincided in that 3-day dissociative episode.
Oh.
And they got me connected to get an ultrasound. And I'm still speechless when I think about it, because what do you say to that?
Yeah.
One, I have no recollection of what happened in that 3-day period. Two, I don't know if someone came into her apartment or I left.
Mm-hmm.
Three, I'm this messed up and I'm growing another human being.
Yeah, that's a whole.
Like, I can't. And being raised Jehovah's Witness, you know, I really didn't even realize abortion was an option. So it never occurred to me that I could get it aborted. But when they did the ultrasound a couple of weeks later, I had spent a couple of weeks being like, you know, how am I going to prepare myself for this? What am I going to do? How am I going to do this? Mm-hmm. You know? And when I went and did the ultrasound, it was not viable, and it just hadn't self-aborted. So I did have to get an abortion to clear it out before I got a septic uterus. And I got suicidal again. You know, I had a couple of friends that were in recovery for their drug addiction. And one of them I had been locked up with the second time in Human Services Center. And, you know, being broken people, they could recognize when that broke me. And they knew they needed to make sure I didn't kill myself. So they sat with me in shifts.
Mm.
And you know, if they hadn't have done that, I would have completed suicide. I had absolutely zero reasons to exist anymore. Like, there was nothing about me that was worth staying alive. And, you know, one of them has been in and out of prison multiple times because she's never been able to get a grip on sobriety and stick with it. And the other did get sober, and I still talk to. And earlier this year, actually on my son's birthday, I met with a couple of other former Jehovah's Witnesses, and we talked about potentially starting a support group in town, because there's so many of us who have that kind of pure trauma related to everything we grew up with, especially the ones who were born in it and raised in it, as opposed to the ones who came into it later. And like my nephews, I would like to get going to the support group and things like that. But through spending years finding real help and being able to turn my mental health around through cognitive behavioral therapy and STEPS groups and things like that, I finally got to a point where I can honestly look myself in the mirror and say, I love you. And there is not a single person on this earth who could have ever hated me as much as I hated myself. Mm. And now I can say, I love you to myself. And therapy works if you get connected with the right kind of services that meet your needs. Because not everyone just needs a sounding board.
Mm-hmm.
Some people really need hardcore work. And my cognitive behavioral therapy and my in vivo exposure therapy that I went through were life-changing. And the STEPS class, the first time I took it, I didn't take it as serious as I should have. But about halfway through it, I realized that this is actually really useful tools. And it's not like all of the other crappy treatment I've ever gotten. So I enrolled it in a second time. And took all sorts of notes, highlighted pages, you know, all sorts of things. And when I did my cognitive behavioral therapy with my exposure therapy, I had a memo recorder that I would speak about my responses and my perceptions in it. And then I would bring it to my doctor and we would discuss my perceptions and how we can change those perceptions. And I will tell you, with all of the things that I've gone through in my life, changing my perception was harder than any other thing I have been through, and I have survived. And the reason it was so much harder is because I am personally accountable for it 100% of the way. And the other things I just so happened to live through. And that difference that it made in my life, I am a completely different person than I used to be. And I have healthy boundaries and healthy relationships. And, you know, I was able to get to a point where I could co-facilitate different types of support groups. And one of the support groups that I ended up co-facilitating was also a gender diverse support group for adults. And it was really them telling me that my identity is a real thing, that non-binary people are not only real, but also a part of the trans community, was something that was really hard for me to actually accept, because I've always been that outsider. Mm. So people telling me, no, you're not an outsider, you belong here with us, was, it was an experience that I can't say I've ever really gone through in any other way. And, you know, I co-facilitated a two-spirit support group at Flandreau Indian School as well, talking about a lot of this stuff, because these mm-hmm. kids are a lot of the times raised in colonized Christian situations where their identity as a two-spirit person is completely invalidated. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, especially on the reservation, the indigenous peoples that have taken to the colonizers' ways are more homophobic and transphobic than the white people, because there was such a push through the boarding schools and through everything else to destroy that, and you'll be better without it, that people lost those histories. And there is so much intergenerational harm to our two-spirit people across North and South America because of everything they've gone through over the last, you know, 500, 600 years at our hands. And it's going to take so many more generations of unpacking that harm and being personally accountable for how we have perpetuated it before we're going to get to a place where our kids are safe. And, you know, that support group was one tiny way I could mm-hmm. contribute to that harm reduction. And I didn't realize how healing that was going to be for me, providing that. But that between that and becoming a board member for Sioux Falls Pride and, you know, doing all of my other community volunteering that I was doing, those, I found that volunteering and being involved in grassroots was the one way I could have a true impact on the people around me. And with everything I've experienced in my life, everything from my trauma to homelessness, the poverty, you know, my physical disability, my health, being able to affect positive change for a future generation means more than all of the gold in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's everything we're supposed to be. We're all supposed to be walking each other home through this life. And I get to live that every day now. And who would have ever thought that I would have gone from that story to now?
I'm sure you didn't ever think mm-hmm. that.
I didn't even think I'd be alive by this age. I never thought I'd live this long.
you've become quite a leader in the community. And I was thinking about that the other day and how your volunteerism and community service has taken you into leadership. You're always the first person to say, how can I help? What can I do? You take it upon yourself to do things like start a nonprofit, Quilting Allies, to help kids that are like you were, really hurting, really traumatized, and needing comfort, love, acceptance. And I want to thank you for your role in the community and how you have poured that into people, and this will be felt for generations to come. So Thank you for using your story to help make other people's lives better.
And say, I'm always uncomfortable when people say thank you, because I don't want to be thanked. I don't want to be noticed. Mm-hmm. I feel like all of us who are on a healthy path just want to be the person we needed when we were a kid. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if we all just stay true to that, everything else falls in line. And it'll all happen in different ways. Because if too many people walk the same path, things fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. And then there's redundancies. So each person's individual things that they bring through the table are really important. And I really prefer the indigenous way to look at life, as opposed to the way white people and Western society look at life, because Western society looks at things as linear, and the indigenous way of looking at things is circular. Because in a line, there's a pecking order. There's people over here and people over here. There's always going to be another. But in the indigenous way of life, it's a circle, because everyone, no matter how different or similar they are, has a place in it, and they are all equal. Mm-hmm. And that changing that view allows you to treat every single person with the dignity and respect that they deserve as a human being, as opposed to trying to look at their triumphs or status to be what deems how you give them respect or time or anything like that in the world. And it's just, it's a good way to be a better human.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you'd like to share about your life, your journey? You mentioned that you have a son.
Yeah. He is a beautiful human, and I taught him how to have boundaries with people, and he can do it on his own. And like, he probably hates me saying stuff like that, because to him it's just everyday life. But to me, I taught another human being how to have boundaries and self-respect. And I think that's so freaking cool that he can apply those to the world and actually be like, no, you don't get to do that with other people, but also be compassionate. Like, he also volunteers and does things, and he's a good human, and he's very empathetic and compassionate, and he's genuinely good. And I can't wait to see what kind of human he grows up into.
It's exciting to be able to watch that and to know that you get to walk him through that.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. Your story is full of twists and turns, trauma, victories. A life's journey that I think all of us needed to hear about. So I appreciate you being willing to share and being open about the things that you went through.
You know, if one person can listen to this and be like, I relate to that, I'm glad to know someone else out there is like me, then I'm totally happy for it.
Agreed. It's what we want to.
No one ever has to be alone.
Thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to spend with us. You can find out more about our organization at transformationprojectsd.org and on all the socials at SD Transform Proj, like P-R-O-J. If you have questions, thoughts, or opinions, or have someone in mind who may like to share their story with us, email us at podcast@transformationprojectsd.org. If this episode has been helpful to you in any way, we hope that you'll share it with those in your circle.
There are so many great resources available if you happen to be struggling with suicidal thoughts. You can head to thetrevorproject.org, or you can call and text 988, and you will be connected to trained counselors that will listen, understand how your problems are affecting you, provide support, and connect you to the resources needed if necessary.
Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week.